Welcome to the Full of Tracy Money Audio Commentary. This is Owen Tracy recording. It is 1:16 p.m. that is Pacific Summer Time. Today is May 31st, and today being Friday, it's the big picture, long-term audio and video for the various different asset classes. I thought that today I would just concentrate on long-term charts, and I'd like to kick off with the Treasury yield. This is about as much history as Bloomberg has. It goes back to 1962. We can see that there has been a steady decline in terms of yields since 1981, and it persists. There has certainly been a loss of downward momentum over the course of the last few years, and there was a failed break above 3% at the end of last year, and the dynamic of the failure was larger than the dynamic of the breakout, and now we're seeing the yield come back down, and it is accelerating lower at this stage. So it would be hard to conclude right now that we are back in an inflationary environment, or that there is any real need for higher interest rates, when we think about the fact that the Fed funds rate at the moment is 2.5% and the 10-year yield is 2.13. Well, that alone tells us that we have a very flat yield curve. It's certainly been an argument over the course of the last few months about whether the yield curve spread, which has most often been defined as the difference between the 10-year and the 2-year, is, and it was in fact up by 5 basis points in here today, so that's back up to 20 basis points now, whether this is the most appropriate barometer of the likelihood of a recession, or whether we should look at the 3-month and the 10-year, because that is inverted. One thing that is certainly true about taking the wider spread between the much shorter duration and the long duration is you do tend to get earlier signals, and you also tend to get more false positives. That's why I've continued to focus on this chart of the yield curve spread, because it is not yet inverted. So there are definitely headwinds that are arising right now. The bond market advance that we've seen recently is certainly telling us that there is demand for safe haven assets. And I think we can lay the blame for that squarely at the feet of the trade war. The trade war is a direct response to the fact that China has been engaging in a very dishonest or mercantilist manner for decades, and is only now really being called out for it. And it's only being called out for it in direct response to the fact that the middle class has been hollowed out in much of the OECD. Globalization has primarily benefited the poorest people in the world, but not the middle classes in the developed world. So what has effectively happened is that the rich have become richer, the poor have done better, and that's primarily within the emerging markets, whereas the poorer people and the middle classes have been sacrificed within the OECD to try and civilize China in particular. And that has simply not worked. The attempt to try and bring China back into the fold of the global economy, to try and instill a sense of or a respect for improving standards of governance, the rule of law and property rights, minority shareholder interests, human rights, all of those hoped for developments by raising the living standards in China have failed. And now we're seeing that the realization that that suite of policies over the course of the last 30 to 40 years has been a waste of time. And now the big question is, what can be done with China, since they have absolutely no intention of reforming? Then the question is whether anything can be done now to curtail their advance and to blunt their global ambitions. That's where the real question is at the moment. That is the primary concern, is that we are heading not towards a trade war, but towards a cold war. And that also highlights the potential for proxy wars to become a much more or a much bigger threat. China, because of the lopsided nature of the trade relationship between China and the USA, there isn't a great deal that China can do to combat the tariffs that are being imposed upon it. On a trade perspective, they could certainly boycott the purchases of US agricultural products or consumer goods, and obviously that is going to weigh on companies like Apple and Nike or Yum Brands. But that isn't nearly as big a consideration as, for example, because there's such a massive unbalance between just how much China is exporting relative to what they're importing, that it's a drop in the ocean compared to the impact that tariffs are having on their domestic economy. But they do have the potential to become much more activist on a geopolitical front. So I think that is, I think, really something that is in the future. That is potentially what the yield curve spread and also the contraction in yields is telling us. Then, of course, we have the potential that we are going to see much more. Sorry, I need to. I'm putting up the 10-year. I'm gonna have to type in this. I haven't. There we go. MLT1. Sorry, I'm becoming incoherent trying to remember the ticker. The Merrill Lynch Total Return Index, it assumes that you are rolling forward a futures position indefinitely, and it's at a new all-time high. This is a really quite resounding slap down to the contention that this was an evolving top formation. And I think that's a profound change. I've been saying for years that this is the most important trend in the world, and it has just reasserted on the upside. So the contention that bond yields are going to be moving higher from here has certainly got been put on the long finger. This is a resounding bull market environment when you think about the total return. And when we look at the very long term, there has certainly been a loss of momentum over the course of the last 5 or 6 years, but now it is starting to resolve on the upside. This is before we get modern monetary theory being deployed. I don't think that we're going to have it deployed, at least until, or at least overtly, until after the next election. But I think arguably we already have it. I think this is something that is not really discussed, that when you think about the fact that the Trump administration have engaged in this massive deficit spending, and that the Federal Reserve has very quickly come to the rescue of the markets and said that they are not going to be raising interest rates any further, and that they're going to stop reducing the size of the balance, or contracting the balance sheet. Well, that already tells us that there is at least some form of coordination between the central bank and the treasury. And that's one of the defining characteristics of modern monetary theory, that the central bank will facilitate massive deficit spending on behalf of the government. We already have that, for example, in Japan, and the Bank of Japan's balance sheet also continues to expand. And I think that is also something that we're probably going to see in Europe as well. Something that we have definitely seen in terms of Europe is that it is almost uniquely susceptible to the broader economic environment globally. Germany, in particular, is a massive exporter, and the surpluses that it has enjoyed is very much tied to its success as an exporter. But unemployment in Germany is rising, and it moved meaningfully higher at the last reading, and we got that this week. When we think about the Bank of Japan, the pace of their balance sheet accommodation has moderated over the course of the last 18 months, but it does have potential to pick up again, and that's particularly the case because the yen is starting to strengthen again, and it was stronger today by a full yen. So we're definitely starting to get evidence of demand for safe haven assets, and the yen strengthening through the 110 area over the course of the last few days is additional evidence of demand coming through. And I think it's worth taking a look at this on looking at it the other way around, because when we think about it in terms of the yen starting to rally against the dollar, there is a clear sequence of higher reaction lows, and it had broken the downtrend back in 2016, had the pullback, and now we've had this range in consolidation. It's looking like a type 2 bottom with right-hand extension. So there's potential here that the yen is going to strengthen further. The Bank of Japan is going to do whatever it can to try and arrest that decline. So we have to consider then that there is potential for the Bank of Japan's balance sheet to do better from here. And I think that is also very much a potential outcome in Europe as well. The size of Europe's balance sheet has been going sideways. In fact, Europe was the only central bank that succeeded in taking over €1 trillion out of circulation back between 2012 and 2015, and it caused deflation. So we know what the impact of that is. The fact that the Federal Reserve is reducing the size of its balance sheet is having an impact on growth, and it's certainly having an impact on the perception of growth potential. So there is obviously then a potential outcome that we're going to see a return to significant accommodation. And the fact that bond yields are breaking on the upside, that this is not simply a US phenomenon, but a global phenomenon, where, for example, the 10-year yield on the Bund moved to a new low in here today, and it's at minus 20 basis points. When we think about the Japanese yields, then the 10-year JGB is still at negative levels, and there's very little prospect of it moving back above the zero bound either. Then, obviously, when we look at the performance of some of these other government bond prices or yields, the Australian yield is now down to 1.45% and treading new lows. There is the realistic possibility that we're going to see all of the major government bond yields going into negative territory at some point over the course of the next 3 or 4 years. That is as a direct response to the potential, at least, that we're going to see more than one country adopting modern monetary theory, that there is going to be much more overt seeking of yield. Also, the potential for governments to fail to tackle the populist agenda, that this rise in populism is going to persist. And when we think about the fact that this populism index produced by Julius Baer last year was saying that populism was at an all-time high, or at least similar to what we had ahead of World War II, in 2018. Well, we'd have to conclude that it is higher again in here this year. So we are at a point in history where there is a great deal of uncertainty. One of the reasons why bonds are doing so well is simple enough. It's that people are waking up in the morning and the world seems to be changing. I had a conversation with a veteran subscriber about 10 days ago, where she said clearly that she didn't really have a strong feeling about how things were going, so she'd been putting her money in bonds, and that it was impossible to try and figure out what was going to happen next in terms of the political environment, and that was causing people to raise cash. Well, that is certainly represented in the uptick in demand for bonds. What we also started to see in here today was that the gold price has also started to do better. And it is now back above the $1,300 area. It was up 16 in here today, and it has confirmed support in the region of the trend mean. What I find particularly interesting is that there has been a clear upward bias to trading. That's despite the fact that it has been really very volatile over the course of the last 18 months. But there is certainly the potential here that gold is going to push on the upside. And against a background where government bond prices are at new all-time highs, where the yen has the potential to continue to appreciate, and the dollar it remains a significant in a significant bull market as well, there is the potential that we're going to see gold start to pick up, because with the clear potential that the USA is going to engage in modern monetary theory and potentially even go down to an environment where yields do in fact go negative, then the question is whether the dollar's impressive advance over the course of the last few years is going to persist. What was particularly interesting today is that the dollar was not strong. Now, what I find also is rather instructive is when we look at the long-term chart of the dollar index, it has been ranging below 100 now for the last 4 years, and it's at 97 and three quarters today. So 100 does represent an area of resistance. And certainly President Trump does not want a strong currency. And there is the potential that with the moves that we're seeing in government bonds, that we are at the top of the interest rate cycle. At least we're at the point where no central bank is going to have the in such a competitive environment, there's no central bank is going to be able to raise interest rates. Because if one were to raise interest rates in this environment, then that would strengthen their currency. And I think, as David used to say, there is no country wants a strong currency, but some do need a weaker currency more than others. If we are at the top of the interest rate cycle, then the only way is down from here, and that is what international bond markets are pricing in. Now, when we think about that yield curve spread, we have to, I think, pay some attention to manufacturing data, because manufacturing is both very susceptible to the economy and also to the currency. Now, when we look at more back history for the ISM, then every time it goes into negative territory, it does not necessarily mean that there's a recession. But it's when it goes into negative territory at times when you do have an inverted yield curve, that's when things can get really nasty and it's trending downwards. Well, it's not just trending downwards in the USA. Manufacturing data is trending downwards everywhere. It's certainly showing up in Germany. It's certainly showing up in Japan and Taiwan and South Korea and also in China. So this is a very meaningful thing to pay attention to. When we look at the yield curve spread, then it often gives us a long-term view on what to expect. We can get a potential lead indicator of anything from 6 to 18 months out. I did post a report from Morgan Stanley earlier on this week where they have adjusted the yield curve to take account of both quantitative easing and quantitative tightening. And their contention is that the yield curve has been inverted since December, and therefore they are on recession watch because it's already been 6 months since that. Now the big question is, if the bond market is making these signals and the gold market is starting to pick up, then what can we expect from the stock market? Well, the S&P 500 broke down below its 200-day moving average this week. And the most important thing that's happened on this chart has been the big pullback we saw in 2018. That was the largest pullback we'd seen in the context of this bull market in nominal terms. Now, when we look at this market on a logarithmic scale chart and think of from the perspective of unleveraged investors, then each of these bigger pullbacks has represented a, excuse me, every each one of these bigger pullbacks has represented a buying opportunity. Now, when we just look at what is effectively a 1,000-day moving average or a 50-month moving average, then we have evidence that the market tends to find support in the region of the 1,000-day moving average during secular bull markets, and it is a pretty useless indicator during these lengthy ranges. Well, if we are therefore in a secular bull market, we should be able to conclude that the index is not going to trade below the 1,000-day moving average on a sustained basis. We certainly know that there have been occasions during the secular bull markets of the past where the market has traded below the 1,000-day moving average on a temporary basis. That was certainly true back in the 1960s, and it was also true in 1987 after the crash. It got right down to test it. Now the bigger question is whether we're going to see a continued bounce from this level now. That's, I think, the big question. If we really are talking about whether we're going to see an additional round of liquidity, which is likely to inflate asset prices even further, then that would take us into another upward leg for this bull market. But if we are at a point where central banks don't provide the liquidity that's required to sustain this liquidity-fueled bull market, well, it's likely that the region of that 1,000-day moving average is going to be tested again. What we certainly know is that liquidity conditions are tightening up. And my chart for the central bank total assets has been contracting over the course of the last 4 months, and it is now back in the region of the lows put in at the end of the third quarter last year, but it is starting to steady up. The weakness of the dollar would be a really impressive and would have a very significant impact on the value of assets sitting on the central banks of countries outside of the USA. So certainly what we've seen over the course of the last 18 months has been liquidity starting to drain out of the global economy. That is also what the banking sectors are telling us. Banks have been underperforming, and there is a sequence of lower rally highs evident on the S&P 500 banks index. When we look at the USA's regional banks, then they really clearly have this type 2 top with right-hand extension characteristics. This is a major trend in consistency that we saw at the end of last year. When we look at the European banking sector, I'll put that on on another log scale chart just to give us some perspective on how long and deep the base formation is. And we're at a point now for European banks that they're going to have to bounce soon if that sequence of higher major reaction lows evidenced since 2013 is going to hold. If it fails to hold, then there's the potential that European banks are going to take an additional leg down. And that is the potential prospect, considering just how reliant Europe is on the export of goods, particularly to the USA and to China. Then I think one of the more important points right now is the renminbi. And it is currently at 6.9. Now, I think it is quite likely it is going to go to 7. But the much bigger question is whether it devalues below 7. What we're certainly seeing is that anyone who is connected to the government or anyone who is considered to be a risk is being denied exit visas from China, and they are being denied the opportunity to avail of the $50,000 limit on purchases of US dollars. So China's definitely starting to get much more serious about capital flight. If we think about the potential that we are, in fact, in a Cold War environment, where the decision has been made that it is now time to curtail China's growth, that it is time to do it now, lest their economy and their military power become too strong in 15 to 20 years' time, so that they will be too strong to then combat. That now is the time to, in fact, start to curtail their ambitions. If that is indeed the case, and I rather think that it is quite likely that that decision has now been made, well, there is ample scope for the renminbi to devalue. There is clear potential that the Chinese economy is going to be experiencing further pressure. When we think about the outlook for the Chinese stock market, excuse me, I need to cough. Then we can see that long term, China's stock market is not an especially consistent performer. It is highly liable to have explosive moves both up and down, and that bull markets generally tend to be state sponsored. And right now, the Chinese administration's interests are not on a stock market boom, but more on trying to hold the line. When we then think about China's government bond yields, what we have certainly also seen is that there has been a compression in 2018, but yields, in fact, rose this year. And that's rather different from what we're seeing in government bonds elsewhere. What this is also suggestive of is that there is stress in the Chinese economy. And the fact that we have such strong commonality in government bonds internationally, but not in China, that is also something that needs to be paid attention to. The other, I think, important point is that when we look at China's banking sector, it is continuing to hold the region of the trend mean. But where the risks reside in China is in the unlisted regional banking sector. And it's really impossible for us to monitor the performance of that sector in an easy fashion. So how well the A600 Banks Index performs doesn't really give us any kind of insight into the outlook for China. But I think what we can conclude is that the continued demand growth for Bitcoin is a clear reflection of the attempts by Chinese citizens to move their money offshore. This is capital flight writ large, and the greatest risk to the advance is that China starts to become much more aggressive on trying to limit capital flight. Bitcoin is essentially a Chinese cryptocurrency. It is primarily mined in China, and a lot of the participants who are trading it are Chinese, the biggest producer of ASIC machines for mining. Bitcoin is also a Chinese company. So China does have a lot of leeway to curtail not only the market but also the mining of Bitcoin, and that represents a rather significant threat. I do think that what we've seen recently, and with the adoption particularly of Ethereum by an increasingly large number of fintech companies, that there is the potential we're going to see a very significant change in terms of the way that business is done and the evolution of a crypto market. I think that's probably the most effective way of describing it. When Ethereum moves to a proof of stake environment, then that is likely to help to increase the speed of transactions. When IOTA eventually does bring a working system to market, then the more people that use it, the faster it becomes, so there is no limit on on speed issues. And that is an existential threat to the banking sector, the fact that Facebook is now getting ready to launch its own cryptocurrency to facilitate money transfers for anyone who has a Facebook or Instagram account, is a testament to just how prolific the potential is for this sector. But Bitcoin itself is very much influenced by what happens in China more than any other factor. If we are in fact moving towards a Cold War, then that is going to very significantly disrupt global supply chains. What's particularly interesting right now, or at least in the last week, is that we saw some data from the Wall Street Journal where exports to the USA from China have been trending down, and imports from South Korea and Taiwan and ASEAN have been picking up. So there is obviously a clear indication of which countries, particularly those that have got mutual defense agreements with the USA, are going to continue to trade within its sphere of influence. Then, if we think about Mahathir in Malaysia, he had statements to make this week about the potential to create a gold-backed currency in the Asian region. And then he was also saying that he wouldn't be told what to do and who to trade with by the USA, which was obviously a bonus for China. Well, the Kuala Lumpur Composite has bounced in here this week, and it was in positive territory in here today. And that is, I think, some confirmation at least that the 1600 point level may in fact hold. When we think about what the risks are, well, the risks are that the trade war does in fact matter to growth in the global economy, not just in the Chinese economy, but that it will infect growth in the US economy. And personally, I think that Amazon is a pretty good barometer of demand for consumer discretionary goods. Well, the share was down $41 in here today, and it is pulling back below, or excuse me, pulling back towards the trend mean. And there is no doubt that the price did accelerate in 2018 because it almost doubled. But when we look at the longer term chart of Amazon and from the perspective of an unhedged investor, then we can also see that it has had a step sequence uptrend, and that each of the steps is about a 30% pullback. So it had a 35% pullback last year, and that was the biggest pullback it had had in percentage terms in really quite a long time, since at least 2010. So the big question now is whether the low holds. If the lows hold and this moves into a more prolonged ranging environment, then this bull market will still be intact and will be in a medium-term correction. If the low does not hold, then there's the potential that we're going to see this incredible bull market rolling over. And considering that we are very close to the peak value, which was $2,050, then there is obviously more downside risk than upside risk in the short term. When we look at the performance of the NYSE FANG index, it has been deteriorating for the last 4 consecutive weeks. And the period of really impressive growth was in 2016 and 17. And it had a larger pullback in early 2018, and that was the loss of consistency at the penultimate high, which is something we often see in very strongly performing markets. So then it moved on to new high ground and pulled back by even more and put in a lower low. Now we have a lower high. The big question for the FANG index is whether that 2000 area is going to hold. But we have had very significant downward dynamics in a number of these extraordinarily high market cap companies. So, for example, with Apple, Apple has pulled back violently. In 2018, it rebounded impressively, and now it is unwinding that advance, and it has just about unwound 50% of it so far. And when people look at the longer term chart, then we're presented with two previous, about approximately 2 year consolidations. And from an unleveraged investor's perspective, then it's reasonable to expect that we would see a range evolve in Apple that could last for 2 years, which means that it could be ranging all the way through 2020 as well as 2019. And that's assuming this is still a bull market. So there is obviously some risk in evolving here. I think we cannot rule out the, or I think perhaps rule out is the wrong word, but ignore the fact that Google had an extraordinarily large downside weekly Q reversal from the peak value, that the consistency of the trend has been lost, that it was one of the most consistent trends in the world, that it had had this sequence of higher reaction lows, that each of the ranges was about $100, and then it pulled back by $200. So $1,000 is now a very significant potential area of support for Google, and if it falls through that level, well, then that is going to represent a major trend in consistency and, think more correctly, a completed top formation. So we are definitely in a corrective phase right now. The very meaningful pullback we've also seen in Facebook shares has not been countermanded. That had its denouement and the massive downside weekly Q reversal in the middle of 2018, having got all the way back up to test the 200 level, it is now pulling back. And that is also contributing to a more ranging environment rather than the consistently trending environment that persisted between the middle of 2013 and the middle of 2018. So these represent some of the largest companies in the world. And when we see that Amazon is also going sideways, and Microsoft had accelerated to get to its peak. Well, Microsoft is still reasonably consistent, but wildly overextended on the upside. So even here, there is potential for some consolidation and a reversion back towards the mean. When we think about the longer term chart of the NASDAQ 100, it definitely paused in the region of the 2000 peak, and then it pushed on to new high ground. If this is still an uptrend, then the lows around 6000 will hold. Now, the potential is that the compression in government bond yields is a sign that the bond market is already pricing in a recession. One thing that I will certainly testify to is that Mrs. Tracy's business has continued to grow, and it's up 30% this year than last year, and it is primarily focused on selling on Amazon. And this year we saw that sales were better in May than February, and that isn't something we'd seen before. Usually people spend more on Valentine's Day than they do on Mother's Day and graduations. So there is the potential that retail sales are not going to be as bad as everyone is making out. If Amazon sales do start to dip, well, then that would be a clear and real-time example of slowing demand growth in terms of consumer demand. One thing, though, is that with oil prices starting to come back down, then that is removing a headwind to growth. And oil prices have been down in a very dynamic manner in here this week. I think it is particularly illustrative to look at the long-term chart of oil. Because when we look at it on a logarithmic scale chart over not just the last decade, but the last century, then what we're presented with are these very long-term ranges. And then they are eventually going to be resolved by massive bull markets. And those bull markets last for about a decade. And effectively, they last as long as it takes for new sources of more expensive supply to be brought online. And then the price starts to come back down to the new marginal cost of production. Well, what we now know is that the marginal cost of production is between about $30 and $40. Previously, it had been at the lowest lows that we'd seen in the previous range was about $10. So the marginal cost of production has gone up fourfold during this bull market in order to bring on new sources of supply. But there is a lot of oil becomes economic at $80. So the chances of the price getting back up to $100 and more dollars on a sustained basis in the absence of a war is really quite unlikely, and that we are much more likely to have a lengthy period of ranging between about $35 to $40 and $75 to $80. And the price having failed now, there is the clear potential that it is going to come back down and test the lower side of its range. That isn't so much a response to slowing demand growth, but rather it is a reflection of supply growth. Then, if we think about the fact that copper prices have also been rather weak and we're down in additional negative territory in here today, well, that is more a reflection of what's going on in China than anywhere else, as well as the fact that a lot of additional supply has come into the market. So these are, I think, rather significant factors that we are seeing commodities that are reflective of industrial demand growth starting to flounder. But grains and beans are doing better. And there is a supply and elasticity environment here. Corn prices, however, were a little weaker in here today, and it is right in the region of the upper side of the range put in over the course of the last 5 years. Then, when we look at the wheat price, it has also been steadying in here, but it was in negative territory in here today. I think one of the important points here is grain prices are really very low, and we've had some short covering over the course of the last 4 weeks. Coffee prices are very low, and we've had some short covering over the course of this week. Now, the bigger question is whether the gains can be held and the downtrends broken. That's going to be a particularly important question for coffee prices next week. If China is going to experience a deeper process of consolidation, that there is the risk that China is going to have a recession. That is obviously going to have an impact on the commodity producers. The fact that the Australian dollar has been trending downwards isn't simply a response to the fact that interest rates are coming down, but also because of the fears about China and the impact it would have. What we're also seeing is that Canadian growth is starting to moderate, and that is also heavily dependent on what we see in terms of the support that China lends to the currency. And the Canadian and the Australian dollars are quoted opposite to each other, so rising charts here represent a weakening Canadian dollar. What I think is also worth considering is when we do look at the S&P 500 and that 1,000-day moving average, it is supportive of the view that we are in a secular bull market. And when we think about the evolution of technology and the potential for cloud computing to continue to have a deflationary effect, that it is likely to have the same kind of effect on I guess on white collar workers that offshoring has on blue collar workers. And that kind of cost saving is something that should be beneficial in a slowing economic environment because companies will generally invest in anything that saves costs in a slowing environment. And that's assuming that the USA does slow down. Then I think when we think about the potential for natural gas, which is at very low levels, to create markets, this really is economics 101. When you have lots of a commodity around, people will figure out how to use more of it. Well, the answer so far has been to dump using coal, but the coming demand growth scenario is for hydrogen fuel cells, and an increasingly large number of automotive companies are bringing electric vehicles to market that have got range extenders, and those range extenders are hydrogen fuel cells. And that's viable because natural gas prices are trending down. Well, then we have the potential for gene editing to represent a very significant factor in healthcare over the longer term. We have the artificial intelligence and deep learning, which is a factor in just about everything right now. Well, all of these factors are going to contribute to a secular bull market. And when we think about the Dow gold ratio, well, it does not go up in a straight line. I do think there is potential in the short term for gold to outperform. That doesn't necessarily mean that the secular bull market hypothesis is going to completely be eroded. But we are in a corrective phase, and the regions of the trend mean have not held for the major indices. The German economy looks like it is going to go into recession, and it will probably take the rest of Europe with it. The trade war with China does not look like it is going to get resolved in the near term. I continue to think that both sides have an incentive to make a deal, but trust has been lost. And at a minimum, that's going to take time to resolve. The escalation of trade frictions between the USA and Mexico last night is also representative of something that is damaging to sentiment. And it is this damage to sentiment and the acceleration in the rally that we're seeing in bond prices that is resulting in the profit-taking that we're seeing in the stock market. So that is, I think, a rather significant factor. Then when we think about the fact that if we want to really start to think about what are the risks, where is the problem that is potentially going to create a recessionary environment? Well, the consumer has largely deleveraged, so it is unlikely to be the consumer is the epicenter of risk in this environment. Although, of course, if the consumer is not doing well, then that is going to be a contractionary impact. But when we think about high yield spreads, we're getting a pretty similar environment now that we had back in 2014 and 15. And that suggests that there is potential here for high yield spreads to move meaningfully higher. There are huge numbers of bonds that are currently rated at the lowest investment grade of BBB. And if they were simply to be valued based on their leverage ratios, more than half would be already downgraded to junk. Well, that is the kind of logical inconsistency that evolves in bubbly environments that will eventually be explored in a bear market environment. In other words, major manias are defined by contradiction. And that's the kind of contradiction in the corporate bond market that is unsustainable. It is completely dependent on access to liquidity. If liquidity conditions tighten and government bonds start to hoover up more of the available capital because of absence of appetite for risk, then we're going to see high yield spreads marching higher. And high yield trades like equity, so some risk getting taken off the table in high yield is a representative of a commensurate change to the demand in the stock market. And this march higher in high yield spreads is happening in Asia and also in Europe. So if we're thinking about what the potential problem is, it's that we're going to have a fallen angel problem. We have already seen what has happened to companies like Kraft Heinz. They have had to write off their intangible, inverted commas, assets. And the share has been trending down now for more than 2 years. But going from 90 to 27 for what was essentially one of the biggest household name consumer goods companies is reflective both of the quantity of debt that the company had taken on during the private equity period and then subsequent to its list or prior to its listing, and also to mismanagement and those intangible assets. And then I think GE gives us a very clear example of what we can expect next. That after the massive decline, then you get a new CEO and they start selling assets. There is $3 trillion in private equity dry powder that is sitting on the sidelines waiting for these kinds of distressed situations to evolve. and they will start picking up the prize assets that go on fire sale as a result of companies doing whatever is necessary to try and hold on to their investment grade rating. That is something that is out there on the horizon. What it also suggests is that some of the best buying opportunities in at any corrective phase that evolves from here in is likely to be in the bond markets rather than specifically in the equities, because you will be able to lock in extraordinarily high yields. That, I think, is what we definitely saw with General Electric last year, and there are an increasingly large number of companies that are going to fit into that category as we move forward. And one of the things that I've tasked myself with is trying to identify more of them. What is particularly interesting about Kraft Heinz is that their yield has not particularly been affected, despite the fact that the share price has been pulling back very violently. Well, what that suggests is that the share price is going to have to pull back by even more to create a distressed environment in the bonds. That's one potential risk. The only way we're going to have a risk in terms of the sovereign is if we have a strike by buyers. But as long as people are buying bonds for capital flight's sake, then that is unlikely to evolve. There is, of course, the potential that if we move into a Cold War scenario, that you will have outright adoption of modern monetary theory, which will justify the Federal Reserve and the Treasury, or the central banks and the treasuries of different countries, working hand in hand to protect their economies from what is effectively a war footing. That it would be a very clear rationale for breaking the rules as they stand today. And that would support asset prices. That would ensure that we have low yields. That would also help to create the bull market environment that would see this secular bull reassert on the upside. So we are in a corrective phase, and we're at the point where the central banks of the world, having tightened too much last year, need to get creative quickly in order to really start to support the liquidity conditions that we have. In the meantime, we're still in a corrective phase, and considering that the major indices have broken their trend means, now the potential is that we are going to see further testing of underlying trading, potentially even a retest of that 1,000-day moving average. In other words, getting back down towards, but perhaps not exceeding, the lows put in December, which is very much in tune with a lengthier, wider corrective phase, which is often characterized by what we would see in the first half of the third year of the US presidential cycle. It is normal to see a somewhat larger pullback so that the Federal Reserve has the rationale it can use to ease policy, and then the fourth year is generally the best performer in terms of the four-year cycle. And the conditions for that outperformance are set following the bigger pullback you get in the first half of the third year. And so far, that presidential cycle is going very much in line with what we can expect. That's why I think we are in a corrective phase, but I don't believe that this is yet time to panic. And but obviously we have to continue to monitor the price charts, and certainly we have seen very meaningful moves in bonds, which are getting overextended, and we have moves in equity prices that are challenging to say the least. And I think with that, I will leave you for today and the weekend, and wish all the best to all of you.